Welcome to Trial by Wine. We take a closer look at crimes that highlight how fascinating humans can be. Schmitty, Swanee and Clarkey visit crimes and run them through their jury of three, debating both sides of the case to agree an appropriate, if totally fictitious, sentence. Please be advised, Trial by Wine may include explicit or disturbing content and will include drunken rambling. Listener discretion is advised. All right, how are we?
Not too bad. How are you?
Super duper. Yourselves?
Oh, fantastic. Yes, yes. Yes. About a week and a bit ago, I broke my arm. Just following the run of shit things that can happen in my life in the last 3 months. But, you know, I suppose it could have been worse. I could have drowned or something, and I didn't. So, you know, always look on
there's
the bright side.
Oh, there's
a silver lining.
I forgot to mention in my litany of things before the program, can you see the mark on the bottom of my chin?
Yeah. No.
Did you bang that's your chin as well?
That's where my head hit the deck as well. Yeah.
Little mark. Oh, my God.
It was a lot bigger. Yeah. Broke my arm, probably broke some ribs and smashed my chin, but didn't actually do any lasting damage to my face, and that's all that matters.
God.
That's right. What about you?
It reminds me, my Facebook has started showing up all of these battles in the natural world. So, you know, there'll be like a cheetah drinking at the water and it's looking up because it's worried something's going to happen, and then all of a sudden a crocodile comes out and gets it. So all this sort of stuff's happening. Anyway, today's one, which is the one that's reminded me of you, was a little baby iguana, and it's buried somewhat in the rocks. And it's got its eyes out like this. Yes, because there's like, I don't know, 10 or 15 snakes around.
Oh, no.
And so then it cuts to, and so I'm feeling like the snakes are life and you're the iguana. And so the snakes all are chasing another iguana, and this one's kind of going, when do I go? When do I go? And I feel like you're dodging all of the snakes.
I think I might have seen something like that too.
It's quite traumatic. And then I couldn't work out.
You're right, Clarky.
I think I've seen it.
If the description of my life is quite traumatic, you're bang on 100% correct.
No, but I couldn't work out if the iguana, because they showed an iguana getting eaten, and I couldn't work out if that was the one that was trying to hide or if that was one that the snakes got and this one got away. And so I'm none the wiser as to how it's going to end, Schmitty, but let's hope for your sake you get away fine.
What a wonderful analogy for life. Never sure how it's going to end.
The iguana and the snakes. Other than that, all is good.
Yeah. And Swanee?
Very quiet over here. Nothing really happening. Just heading towards the end of school holidays. Thank goodness.
That should
be 7 Have you hit 400 degrees yet?
Oh, my God. It's actually quite relatively cool, but I don't want to jinx us. But for the entire school holidays, it has not been rainy one single day. And on one occasion, I've never been to an outdoor cinema, and a girlfriend had a birthday a Friday week ago, and we went and saw a film in an outdoor setup, and a storm came through. And it was like, we don't even really have storms, we just have nothing. So the movie started at 8:30. We'd arrived at 7 and we're drinking and we're all sit down. We're having a wonderful time. And I could see the lightning and I thought, oh, I wonder. But we didn't have a big view of the sky. We were quite contained. It was like in a modern cinema in their back sort of yard kind of thing. So it was all blocked out. So you couldn't truly see the weather front coming across. Well, it was huge. And it was a very late night because they ended up showing us the film inside instead because it was like in a normal cinema.
That's still good.
But, yeah, so that was quite lucky. But that is the only time it has rained.
It's rained.
And I'm talking, it has not even been overcast for a full day. Like we might have had a bit of cloud cover at one point. It has just delivered. It has just been, I honestly think I look like an old leather bag. We went to a party yesterday and there wasn't really any sun cover. Anyway, so I had like a summer dress on. And by the time I got home, I caught like the side of my back and I went, oh, my God, I'm like someone out of, you know, there's something about Mary, that Magda. I've got a bit of Magda about my back where it's so dark from the sun. I just look like an old handbag, a bit of leather. Anyway, that's about all that's happening in WA, getting a tan.
Okay, so I suppose we should introduce ourselves. I'm Schmitty.
I'm Swanee.
And I'm Clarkey. And together we are
Trial by
Wine.
And what are we drinking?
Oh, very excitingly.
A whole lot of not wine.
Oh, big news in our house. We don't seem to have any Diet Coke or Coke Zero.
What?
And when I say we don't seem to, when I say we don't seem to, I've noticed children's bins happen to have a few of my little slimline cans in them. So people
Has
must have gone cray cray when mum and dad were out yesterday. No, not yet. No one was actually home when I went to find one just then. So I'm on a soda-y, like raspberry flavoured soda, but it's not that great.
Right. You need to get yourself a little bar fridge with a padlock on it. Lock
with
it
a padlock. We've got three fridges. It's not the fridge that's the problem. It's the padlock is needed.
Lock it up and put it in your recording studio so that you're always ready to grab one. Yeah.
Maybe have a bit of a read.
Water cannon and a motion sensor, I reckon it
works. I was thinking of doing like a booby. I mean, I do booby traps occasionally, but nothing major. Just like I'll leave like little notes and things that are quite rude or funny or whatever else for them, which is like, you know. My polite language, go away. But yeah, there was nothing left. What are you guys drinking?
What do you want, boys?
We're just on a Great Northern, a mid-strength beer.
Another beer.
Because it's...
Goodness.
Yeah.
Is it hot?
Summer days.
I am drinking a vermouth, which is unusual, a vermouth. And I discovered this vermouth when Tony and I went to Hillsville for my birthday last year. We went to this little independent, I won't say winery, it's like a bunch of different people who produce small batches of wine and then sell it in this collective kind of place. Mm-hmm. It's called Peyton and Jones, and it's across the road if anyone wants to go from Four Pillars Gin Distillery. They import this vermouth. It's called Fotli, F-O-T-L-I. And at the time they told us that you can only get it through them. And then when the bottle was finished, it took me about 6 months to get through it. It is very nice. I looked it up and it's at Dan Murphy's, but it's quite nice. I can recommend. Yeah. All right. So who's got a story?
I do. I have a story.
Great. Tell us. Tell us more.
Yes. So the story that I've got today is one that I've kind of been avoiding in some ways. It's something that I was aware of, but not truly of the details, but it's one of those things that the best way I could describe it is that it does occupy sort of real estate in my mind, especially when it comes to thinking about crimes and things that have really, really sort of scared me to a point where it's impacted on my own life. So I need to take you back to 2006. And the way I first found out about this crime was I was living in the UK and I came back to Perth with my fiance. Because I'd actually already been technically married in Europe and then we came back and we had a wedding here. But when I came back, I took my niece out shopping in the lead up to our wedding party. And when we went to a shopping centre, she was telling me about a little girl who'd been taken in a public toilet in a shopping centre. And I remember thinking, oh, is that right? And I just was not aware of the story at all anyway. So it was the year that it happened and it was a big story. And I think the details were not totally made aware to her. So then I had spoken to a few people about that time. And it's always been one of those things that I obviously then went on to have children in the year after that, I think. And I've always been sort of very impacted by that and the Madeleine McCann thing, because again, that was all as I was about to have children. So when you're really going into that mode, they're the kind of things that you sort of pick up. So, and I've mentioned this before, I have a huge fear of public toilets. And I think I had it before this happened, but it's so heightened for me that even now I don't feel comfortable with my kids who are, you know, teenage boys going into toilets. Even my husband, I just don't like the idea of going into these places that sometimes are dodgy, sometimes it could be somewhere perfectly nice, but I just think it's such a obvious spot for bad people to lurk. So that was sort of in my mind and always has been in my mind. You know, heaven help me, in an airport, I've had three kids and myself in one cubicle quite often. Again, not recently when they were younger, but it just has had such a massive impact on me, because when these things can happen, they can happen very quickly, as I'm about to sort of tell you. So this crime happened in 2006 and it happened in Perth, Western Australia, which is where I live. And the thing that I find really interesting about this is I've lived here now for coming on to 7 years and I have never, not once, ever heard anyone talk about this crime. And I just, I can't believe that. I think if I brought it up, people would definitely be able to talk about it. But no one talks about it in kind of, there are no jokes, there's no flippancy, it doesn't come up. Yeah. Whereas Claremont, the Claremont killer, absolutely, I've heard people talk about that ad nauseum because a lot of people my age were, well, they knew some of the people who were the victims, but they were also out and doing things and catching taxis and hitchhiking and, you know, going to the clubs and restaurants, bars, whatever else that featured in that story. But this, I find it kind of strange. In fact, there have been times in the last couple of years where it still pops into my mind where I think, did that really happen? Like, is that my mind where I've taken part of something and made it into something else? So in looking mm-hmm. into it, it's absolutely not something that was in my mind or that I made up. And it's quite a shocking story because it involves a child. So I think of all of the episodes that we do, yeah, this is absolutely trigger warning. There's nothing very pleasant about this one, but I'll try and do it justice in terms of telling you what happened. And then also the sort of some of the interesting things that happened as a result of this crime occurring. So first of all, I need to introduce you to a little girl, and her name is Sophia Rodriguez Urrutia Shu, which is a little bit of a mouthful, and that's because I think she's, well, I know her parents were, her father was from Spanish background and her mother was Asian, but I don't know exactly where from, but that's why her surname is a little bit of a mouthful. And Sophia Rodriguez Urrutia Shu lived in suburban Perth in south of the river, and she lived in, I think she was in Canningvale. Well, that's certainly, yeah, I think she lived there. Well, certainly lived close to it. I don't know the exact details of where she lived. It's sort of never been released. But she lived with her mother and father. Her mother, Josephine, was a stay-at-home mum, and her father, Gabriel, was a businessman who actually spent quite a lot of time up in Hong Kong running their family business. Again, I can't find any details as to what that was, but basically they were a family with four children, of which Sophia was the third child. So she had an older brother and sister and a younger sibling who I don't have any access to that child's name, but essentially a family of four, fluffy white dog, suburban Catholic primary school, just a really kind of run-of-the-mill family living in a nice suburban setup. And she was described as, I'm saying it in the past tense because we obviously know where this is going, but she was by all accounts just a sweet little girl. She believed in Santa Claus, she believed in the Tooth Fairy, and in the lead up to the crime that I'm about to share with you, she had been waiting for the Tooth Fairy to come. So each night, I don't know what happened in her house. In my night, it was like, I think the parent had to get it done straight away, otherwise someone would be complaining, going, oh, they forgot. Apparently she'd been waiting, like, I'd read somewhere, 15 days for this Tooth Fairy to come. I was like, what kind of parent does that? So she was absolutely delighted. And no, right? That was a big fear of mine, because my kids will think that I have short, look, not I, that the Tooth Fairy's forgotten about them. Isn't it strange how you read stuff and think, God, that really sticks in my mind? I was like, she got away with it. The parents got away with it for that long. Yeah, they were saying that, you know, she was just a sweetheart. She was good with her little sister, and if a little sister came to her, she would, you know, crawl into bed, and she was, you know, growing into a really thoughtful young girl. She was only eight, and you know, she was pretty quiet, but she was very determined. And her parents said, like, if she ever hurt herself, she'd never cry. She wasn't one to complain. She didn't really make a lot of noise. She was just happy little girl, a lot of smiles, really liked to sing and dance. You know, had her best friends at school. And, you know, I think life would have been really quite simple and fun and lovely. And on the 26th of June 2006, she was collected from school by her uncle and her older brother. And I believe his name is Gabriel as well, which is the same name as his father. And they headed off to what I would call a suburban shopping centre. So not a massive mall, not that kind of thing, more one that's sort of like food and what you'd call in Australia a variety store. It had a big W in it. So the kind of stuff that you go and you run errands in, you're not Westfield. Going out for a big shop. No, not even a Westfield. Think no, lower than that.
No, before Westfield, like Airport West Westfield.
Oh, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, trust me.
Westfield lower, to me lower. Seems big and glamorous here. No, no.
Yeah, no.
Do you know what I mean? It might have had, you know, a couple of, you know, different types of supermarkets and fresh food stores and that kind of stuff in it. It's called Livingston Marketplace, and I've heard it described as unremarkable, a bit bleak, a hub for supermarkets and car parks and a couple of fake fast food style outlets that are not necessarily the big ticket ones. They're not like, well, I don't know if there is a McDonald's, but, you know, where someone's having a go at, you know, sushi or, a, I don't know, fried chicken or something like that, you know, that kind of stuff. So it just it could have been anywhere, just sort of a nondescript shopping centre. You pop in and do your groceries at, probably. So Sophia was in her school uniform when she and her family, well, her uncle and her brother, were walking around Big W. They must have been there on a mission. She was in great mood, happy about having just been picked. She was going to be part of an Indonesian dance routine with her friends the following week. But as they were browsing the aisles and looking for whatever they were, she mentioned to her uncle that she needed to go to the toilet, and he just said, "No, just wait, just wait, just wait." So when they got to the front of Big W, where he could see the toilets, he said, "Okay, well, I'm at the cashier, so you can head off now." So over Sophia went. So she's head off to the toilets, and at that point, there was CCTV footage obviously outside the Big W, but sure enough, it wasn't working on this day. At the same time, a young man by the name of Dante Wyndham Arthurs was also at Livingston Marketplace that afternoon. Dante worked at Livingston Marketplace in the fruit and vegetable section. When I say section, I think, you know how there's like an old style grocery. Fruit and veggie place. Yeah. And he was like a regular, he had done the night fill job the night before. So he wasn't there in a capacity that he was working. He was just
hanging out. You know,
he'd gone to run some errands. Yeah. So he lived nearby. He lived with his parents in a recently built single story, pale bricks of new build.
Yeah.
New build. That was situated just, well, not even, just, you know, I've read a couple of hundred metres, I've read a kilometre, but very close to the shopping centre, Livingston Marketplace. Yeah. And in 2 days' time, he was scheduled to fly to England for a holiday to see family and friends. So he had headed down to run some errands, and I think he wanted to convert some money or something. So he got up late, had a bit of an argument with his mum, who was having some discussion about whether or not he was able to claim leave, paid leave when he was on holidays, because as I said, he was going to the UK. And then off he headed, he drove to the Livingston Marketplace. At the shopping centre, Dante Arthurs transferred money for his holiday. And then he went to Big W, where he looked for some board games. Couldn't afford to buy any of the games, and he got a little bit irritated, and then he decided he needed to go to the toilet. He tried the men's toilet and found it locked, and then he went to the disabled toilet. Now, at this point, I have read so many different views of what actually happened at this point. We kind of know the outcome, but again, each of them is slightly different, so I don't truly know what I don't think anyone truly knows, but there have been a number of different versions of what occurred at this point in terms of who was where and how people got to be where they were.
So, Swanee, just before you get on to what happens after he goes to the disabled toilet,
yes,
do you want to maybe tell us what your sources are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my sources are theage.com, news.com.au, dailymail.com, and The West Australian. And in particular, there was one article written by Kate Hampson back in 2008, and I found that really, really useful, actually, because she'd interviewed the parents, and it gave a real sort of, I guess, colour to Sophia and her family situation. I was a little bit, maybe not surprised, but there is not a great deal of information available on Dante Arthurs other than what I'm going to share with you. It's a bit of a strange, it's kind of a closed book, and I wonder if that's kind of deliberate in a way. There's nothing it could really
be,
spoken on.
It could be like the guy who did the massacre in Christchurch, whose name I can't remember because Jacinda Ardern said, "I'm not going to speak his name.
Yeah,
we don't talk about him. He's nothing to us."
Yeah.
And I it worked.
Maybe the same thing
I have no idea who the guy is. I'd have to look it up.
I do think it is, actually. Yeah. So it's June 26, 2006, and it's now 4 p.m. And
Dante's having a shit in the disabled toilets.
Well, we don't know exactly where he is, but we know that Sophia has headed off to the toilet because her uncle and her brother and sister are standing there.
They at the register.
So off she goes.
Time stamped here.
And we also know at the same time Dante Arthurs had been in Big W as well, and he's headed off to the toilet. Gosh, she's headed down a long corridor. And I think I have seen photographs of this, and it is such – we've all been in this exact – I need you to describe it to you. So imagine you've got your shop front for Big W, and it literally was just to the left, just outside. And it's one of those ones that I remember probably from maybe a 70s shopping centre, doors that will go in that then will close up And then down a long hallway, there will be a men's toilet facility, a ladies' toilet facility, and a disabled toilet.
Yep.
And I don't know the configuration of those, but that's what was down a long hallway, all fluorescent lighting and directly outside the Big W. It was not, you know, down the way, round a corner. It was, you could see it. You could see the shutters of the Big W in the photographs when they were taking photos of it later on. So 4 p.m., she's at the Livingston Shopping Centre in Canning Vale. So while her family wait, off to the toilet, Sophia goes. And they sort of wait for her in the main area once they've come out of the shopping centre. And her brother starts to think, oh, just go and check on her. So he walks down into the corridor and he first of all goes to the ladies' toilets, of course, and yells out, Sophia, Sophia, doesn't hear anything. He does the same to the men's toilet. He doesn't hear anything. And then he goes to the disabled toilet and he goes and realises the door's locked. And he said he could hear a noise or rustling in there. So he said something. And I've read two different things. One says that he could hear a male voice, so he moved on. And the other one, it was just that he'd heard, you know, rustling and activity, so he knew someone was in there, so he moved on. So at that point, he goes and rejoins his family. And as a few more minutes go by, they do start to get a little bit worried. So clearly she's not in the toilet, so they think, well, where's she gone? So they decide to head off. So the sister and the uncle head off to another set of toilets that they know is at another end of the shopping centre, and they've headed off that way, and Gabriel, her brother, sort of stays in the area. And it's only a few more minutes later that he then heads back into the corridor to check to see that she's, you know, maybe she's there. She's got to be there somewhere, right? So he goes back down the corridor and he gets to the disabled toilet door, which is now slightly open. And as he pushes the door, again, two totally different stories. I've read absolutely in the West Australian that Dante Arthurs was leaving the toilet, and I've read elsewhere that he just found his sister. So I don't know what happens there. In the story that I'm going to go with is that, and I've seen this twice, is that he pushes the door and this big, big, burly, overweight man looks him dead in the eye very quickly and then runs off. And Gabriel looks in and his sister is collapsed on the floor, naked.
Jesus.
So initially he runs after Dante, well, he doesn't know it's Dante, but he runs after this man and he can't keep up. He's sort of lost him. So then he runs back and he's screaming and asking, you know, everybody for help. And of course, then everybody comes in. This was all done within a period of 3 to 5 minutes. It was so quick. The whole thing from start to finish, I think, is about 10, but the time that he would have been in there and had her in that cubicle is 3 to 5 minutes.
Bloody hell.
And this is the awful bit. So really, if you're not up to it, I really would suggest that this is probably not the right, this would be the right time to
jump forward 10 minutes from now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So when her brother found her, she was naked. He'd restrained her and in doing so had removed her clothes and he had broken both her legs.
Oh, Jesus.
In 3 to 5 minutes. Oh. Both of her legs. I mean, she was a tiny little 8-year-old
girl. Tiny little girl. And he sounds like a mess.
But he was just a big
brutish
unit. And they don't know if it's totally from getting her in the door when he's grabbed her to take her in. And again, that's another thing where I've seen conflicting stories. One is that she'd walked into the disabled toilet and he was there and he's grabbed her and pulled her in. There was another that she'd been to the, because there's no footage, right? And he's never said. And whether he'd grabbed her and pushed her into the, how she got in there, no one actually truly knows.
Yeah.
But she sure as hell ended up with him. So her legs were both broken. And I read that her left arm was dislocated somewhere else. I read that one of her arms was broken, but certainly she had been, and one of it said was to do with twisting her legs. Oh, God. Her legs had been twisted so badly in trying to get her in there and getting her undressed. Her school uniform was in the sanitary bin.
Ugh.
And her throat had been so severely compressed that her larynx had been crushed in his attempts to try and keep her quiet. She also had received a severe, I can never say this word correctly, perineal? Perineal, is it?
Yeah,
perineal. Your perineum, so perineal tear. So the little bit between,
everyone
knows what it is.
I assume.
Well, not necessarily. We'll get to that. Yeah. And so that is what was found in a suburban shopping centre, 4 o'clock, well, shortly after 4 o'clock, on a winter's afternoon in 2006. Can you even get your head around how shocking that must have been? It is so bad. It's so violent. That is it, isn't it? The fact that that was all able to be done within 3 to 5 minutes.
It would take you longer than 3 to 5 minutes to imagine that. If you were that uncle looking after the...
Oh, destroy
Yeah, you wouldn't imagine that could happen like that.
Like they'd be going, oh, she's probably gone to the other toilets like they did. They wouldn't even comprehend that that could possibly have happened in that short period of time.
But, and they were really doing the right thing. They'd wait until they got to, you know, she wasn't just allowed to leave the store. They were at the register. You could see the toilet, you know, the entrance to the toilets.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just unbelievable. Yes, as I was saying, in each case that with the broken legs, the breaks were caused by extreme twisting of the bones.
Oh,
medical evidence
it.
Suggests both of Sophia's arms may have been broken while she was alive, although not necessarily while she was conscious. She'd also been sexually penetrated with a finger with a force that had damaged her internally, and there was sperm found on the inside of her right thigh.
Oh, yuck.
What?
So I can only imagine the bedlam that was happening. So the police were obviously called immediately, and the entire shopping centre was locked down. It was the entire shopping centre was a crime scene. But by that point, Dante had already fled. He'd gone out to the car park, jumped in his mum's car and driven home. So you're left with this image of the boy, the brother, Gabriel, just sat with his sister, just broken, naked on the floor, just unbelievable. Not the right thing for any 14-year-old to see, right, or anyone of any age. So in terms of the criminal investigation, as I said, the shopping centre was put into lockdown immediately, and the initial investigations at the shopping centre identified a few possible suspects. Arthurs was known to local detectives due to a sexual assault on an 8-year-old girl in the same area 3 years earlier.
Of course he was.
Police remained at the crime scene well into the early morning, and at 5 a.m. the following day, June 27, the day after Sophia Rodriguez Urrutia Shue's body was discovered, they attended the home of Dante Arthurs. Arthurs was arrested and later charged with willful murder, counts of sexual penetration of a child, and deprivation of liberty. In his interview with police, Arthurs admitted to digitally penetrating Sophia. It could not be determined whether this had occurred prior to or after her death. And this becomes important, which we'll go on to later. During the attack, which was estimated to have lasted between 3 and 5 minutes, Sophia's brother knocked on the door of the cubicle, having heard movement coming from inside while searching for her. Though Arthurs made admissions to hearing the knock on the door and a name being called, neither he nor the police could determine whether Sophia was still alive at that time. Sophia was left dead or dying on the floor as Arthurs made his escape and her brother arrived. It's just so full on, isn't it? Now, so we've got Dante Arthurs now being held, but then you can only imagine like the media storm that this would have whipped up. And straight off the bat, first of all, what's important to know is, although I've said to you that he had, there'd been a previous situation where he'd been known for a sexual assault, the public doesn't know that yet, right?
Yeah.
So at this point, the public are outraged and they don't know who it is, what's happened and who could this be and what do we know? So once the news of Sophia's murder spread and information about her alleged killer was revealed, media organisations locally, nationally and internationally took great interest, and the crime was described by many as the most horrific murder in WA since, there's other ones which we've never covered, but the David and Catherine Burney murders where they murdered a number of young women. Now, what I found really interesting is because, as I mentioned at the outset, I lived in the UK at this time, and there's a connection here to a crime in the UK. So immediately, it, you know, sparked my interest, and I can read an article from the Daily Mail, and it was, the headline reads, "How an internet rumor about a child killer spread across the globe." Yeah, there was a time when gossip rarely travelled beyond the village boundary, but in the modern world, a rumour can race across the globe in seconds. The phenomenon was thrown into focus by a rumour that the man arrested for raping and strangling a young girl in Australia this week was in fact Robert Thompson, one of the killers of James Bulger. Now, I don't know that all of our viewers will know who that is, but I suspect many will. James Bulger was the little 2-year-old, wasn't it, that was taken from a shopping centre. Yeah,
and killed. In the most brutal and horrific and senseless and
just
awful, young boys awful way.
Absolutely. And there was, remember, there was a lot of footage, a lot of stuff, you know, tracking the kids leaving, luring him out along the train lines of the Hobbit. Yeah, it was a big, big story.
Yeah.
So you can imagine back in 2006 when this happened, the world was ready to react. It was claimed that Thompson moved to Perth, claimed that he'd moved to Perth after being released from custody 5 years ago and was given a new identity, that of Dante Wyndham Arthurs, the man arrested for Sophia's death. A police officer was reported to have said photos of Thompson as a boy resembled the man that they had in custody. The story had shot around the world thanks to the internet and the ease with which people can call a friend or, you know, really tens of thousands of miles away, and just it was a frenzy, and it reached such a pitch that Australia's federal justice minister was forced to put out a statement officially denying the story and assuring them that that wasn't the case and that neither of the men involved with JB Bulger's death had been relocated to Australia at all. But again, you know, this you could.
And also, Dante was about to go overseas to London.
And he had lived there at some point. So,
there's some vague connection. But also, he's 21. Does the timing work? Surely the Venables and Thompson did more than... They were 12, weren't they, when they killed Jamie Bulger?
Yeah, maybe.
They must have done more than 8 or 9 years. Anyway, it wasn't them. It wasn't him.
No, it was not them, but it was just... So in that media frenzy and people looking for answers and everybody being involved, you could imagine everyone would have been on to that.
I remember receiving an email about it. I don't know if it was in relation to this case, but I do remember receiving one of those emails that's written by someone who's just trying to wind the world up.
Yeah.
It was back in the day before.
That's a bit old school, yeah.
It was one of those viral email type things. And it sticks in my mind because it was talking about the blokes who had killed Jamie Bulger. It was talking about the justice system having failed the Bulgers because it allowed these two blokes to get new identities and live in sun-soaked, beautiful Australia and go off and do stuff. And what offended me as an Australian living in the UK at the time was a reference to sending, I thought it was something like, I thought we stopped sending our convicts to Australia.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, deporting. I fucking hate that shit. Oh,
it's interesting you should say so that. Angry. It says here on the 29th of June 2006, the British High Commission in Canberra issued a media release stating, there is no connection between the man arrested in Western Australia and the individuals involved in the James Bulger case. Australia has not taken British convicts since 1868.
I find it offensive. Yes.
Well, anyway. Fair enough.
And I also, it goes like slightly off topic, but I don't know if you've seen these Ancestry.com ads where people are like, oh, and I found out that my great-great-grandfather was a bushranger and I'm so proud. Why? Why would you be proud of that?
Don't get you started on bushrangers.
I can proudly say I get very angry about people thinking it's romanticising criminals, basically. But the best I can find or the best that Mum could find in our family tree was a bigamist.
Oh, gosh, wow. Good people.
Knowingly or unknowingly?
Yeah. I'm just going to say record-keeping in the 18-somethings probably wasn't that good.
Okay, so that was one controversy, but this was the bigger controversy truly at the time, was when it was revealed in the local media that Arthurs had been investigated for a sexual assault 3 years earlier in 2003, and what do you know, against another 8-year-old girl. It was reported by media and later confirmed by Western Australia's Police Commissioner Carl O'Callaghan that Arthurs was in fact arrested for the assault. However, the charges were dropped due to insufficient evidence and, most importantly, it was an incorrect police interviewing techniques. So apparently they were too heavy-handed in trying to get...
I'm going to ask a question here. Is this man intellectually disabled?
No, he has Asperger's, but he's absolutely not intellectually disabled. Right. And the interesting thing about Asperger's and how it's described, and it's really not focused on a great deal in this crime because the...
It doesn't excuse it.
It doesn't. It's more interesting in the way he viewed it. It does come to bear a little bit later on when the way he viewed the crime, and that they say that's through the lens of somebody who has Asperger's. It's like he can say he did it, but he can't take responsibility for it, which is complicated but very difficult to try and make sense of.
Let's blame it on a syndrome as opposed to a person taking a conscious decision to do something horrendous.
Correct.
That all checks.
Mm-hmm. And it was also identified that the shorts worn by Arthur's back in 2003 had traces of victim's blood on them, but that wasn't noticed during the 2003 investigation because no one had checked. So it was,
he should have gone
again,
to jail at that point had they investigated properly.
Or even if he hadn't have gone to jail, there was a sense that he would have at least been on a register. Something would have been up.
I can't remember when I said that Perth started its register for sexual
offenders. That's related to this. Yeah, it's this.
Okay.
It relates
all
to
right,
this.
There
yeah.
we go.
So
okay.
it wouldn't, that would have helped, yeah. So that was the thing. It wouldn't have probably made a great deal of difference with it anyway, but if he had have been on someone's radar, or I don't know, maybe it would have helped.
Yeah.
Sophia's family were frustrated by this, and, you know, a couple of years later they did say a few things about it, but I think on the whole they were very, very pleased with how supportive the police had been. And they said, you know, they understood that even if there'd been a conviction, it wouldn't have guaranteed that their daughter would still be alive. It's kind of, you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
She was killed very quickly.
Yes, yeah, yeah, this guy was, yeah. I also had read somewhere what they found in his house when they went there.
Mm, here we go.
They found pictures of young girls with their addresses.
What?
No.
Addresses, there where they lived, their address. Sophia was not one of them. They, it, like, that's freaky, isn't it?
Yeah. That's awful.
Pedophile.
How? Yeah. Do you have any idea how
know.
We got them?
Oh,
we just
followed
them. Saw them. Yeah. It's a bit old school, 2006. I don't think you'd be on the internet doing it. I think you never just saw some girls at a local school or nearby. Imagine finding out your daughter was one of those. I presume that I don't know if people would ever found out, but that was very upsetting. There is one thing that I wanted to share with you, which was a letter that was read out by the family at Sophia's funeral. So her funeral was beautiful. Like, you can see images of it online. And by all accounts, the school that she went to and the community just dug so deep and just totally rallied around each other. It was really quite beautiful. So she was buried on July 4th, and it was done at her school, which was the Mater Christi Church. Oh, sorry. I think that's what you call the school, Mater Christi Church. No, that's not right.
Mater Christi.
Mater Christi Catholic Primary School
yes.
is the name of the school she attended. And, of course, the Mater Christi Church was the church associated with Sophia's Mater primary Christi, school.
Yeah.
They had at least 500 mourners crammed into that little teeny church, and there were hundreds more in the courtyard to pay their respects. The school principal said she was gentle, polite, and respectful, and she'd be missed by all. She's been with our school for over 4 years now, and during this time it has been a pleasure to know such a beautiful soul. So none of the family spoke at the service, but instead a letter was given to each of the mourners, and it said, "Above all, we would like to thank God for letting us share one of his angels for 8 beautiful years. We don't fully understand why she was taken now, not earlier, not later, and in this way, but we know there is a reason. And we ask Sophia to help us find the road that will bring us together once again in heaven when our time comes to be reunited with her. We will miss Sophia and keep her presence in our hearts every day to help us feel stronger. We know that she only wants us to be strong, united, and happy."
God.
Oh, my word. Isn't it just amazing that these parents can have such, I don't know, poise in a situation like that? And everything that I've read, and, you know, I'll come on to it a little bit later, I think they've always maintained this. They were quiet for a very long time, and they had people around them in the community who were their spokespeople. And very interesting, there's another connection for me, which is, at my boy's school, there's an ex-police who comes in and speaks to kids about cybersecurity. And I think he goes to all the schools, and he's an ex-policeman who, you know, he talks to kids. And I've only ever seen him do it online because it was during COVID, so we had to do it, you know, we couldn't all be in the same room. But he's really passionate about keeping kids safe. And I had no idea there was a connection here. And the connection was that his son was in the same school as Sophia the year below. So he was one of the people that kind of became a spokesperson for the family amongst a couple of other people. I think maybe one of the, I can't remember who it was, maybe a teacher, and just a couple of people within the school society and the community really helped them. And then I've also read that I guess it was like a police liaison was with the family the entire time while the whole you know, while they were trying to work out what was happening, to try and protect them from what was going on in the media. So they were trying to get stay ahead of the game so they wouldn't find out. Like that, she said she basically was with them all the time. And they said this woman was incredible, and they had a lot of – they were so thankful that she'd been the person that was given to them. But, I mean, talk about an incredible job. Imagine doing that and helping people through these kind of moments in their life. Just special is not even close to it, hey?
Sometimes the police liaison are there, though, to find out whether or not the people in the family had anything to do with the victim's death too.
I guess they didn't have to worry about it in this case.
She's like, picked him up really quickly, didn't they?
Yeah. That, again, and most of the crimes that we, well, practically everything is always some long drawn out thing. This is not that sort of crime. This was like,
almost like they're like
pretty tidy in that respect.
Person of interest, works there. Yeah. Chances are, let's go pick him up.
As I said, at the funeral, the family didn't speak. And in fact, they didn't even attend the court process. They just couldn't, they couldn't bear it. So they were represented by two members of the Mater Christi Catholic Primary School Parish, and the head priest of the parish, Father Brian Rosling, took up the family struggle to deal with the massive media attention the murder had raised. And Paul Litherland, the man I mentioned, at the time a Western Australian police officer and a parent, also represented the family, and he set up fundraising events for them. So I thought this man was really impressive in terms of how he speaks to young people anyway about keeping them safe and what could happen with, you know, cyber crime. But now that I'm aware of this, I'm just like totally blown away. I'm not surprised that a lot of people here in Perth must know who he was anyway, whereas I wouldn't have known that.
Mm.
So a lot of people would go, oh, he's the guy associated with, you know, Sophia Rodriguez.
And he's obviously affected by the whole thing as well, isn't he? Like,
oh, absolutely. Oh. Imagine that. So on March 7, 2007, after extensive psychological testing and discussions between prosecutors and Arthur's defence counsel, Arthur's was required to enter a plea to the charges of willful murder, two counts of sexual penetration of a child and unlawful detention. He pleaded not guilty to all four charges and was remanded in custody.
I do assume that there was a DNA match with the semen found on her and him. It's a slam dunk, isn't it? There's no question that it was someone else.
Well, there's no discussion about that, so I presume they probably would object to it, but it's not talked about. Because, I mean, normally it's something we need. Because remember...
And in 2006, they could have done that.
The brother had seen him. Leave the cubicle. Again, I have read differing versions.
The version's
correct. And the version that I'm reading is from the West Australian. So I'm assuming that would be probably one of the best
fact-checked
sources in this particular for this story. Okay. Whereas, you know how sometimes I see things and I can tell that they're watered-down versions of different things that people have collaborated. Yeah, absolutely.
I was writing one today and listened to five different versions or looked at things.
Correct.
What's true? Yeah.
Arthur's was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome by forensic psychologist Greg Deer.
Do we just call that autism now?
Now you do.
Asperger's is not popular anymore.
So at the time it was,
everyone seems to have it. Yeah.
It was very popular. I remember hearing a lot about it in relation to my own family. But yes, I believe that it's
all on the spectrum. That's why it's called the spectrum.
Oh, we're all on the bloody spectrum. Trust me. But yeah, there was quite a bit of chat around it for us. On July 31, Chief Justice Wayne Martin ruled that Arthur's would receive a bench trial. Martin said that the extensive, continuous, in some respects extraordinary, pre-trial media coverage, the circumstance of the offence, and the fact that the judge would provide, they couldn't do it by trial.
It's prejudiced.
Hence, it was agreed that Arthur's would be heard by a judge and not a jury. In the meantime, discussions continued with the Director of Public Prosecutions and Arthur's lawyers regarding his plea status. In August 2007, Arthur's and prosecutor entered into an agreement that would see Arthur's plead guilty to the lesser charge of murder instead of the current charge of willful murder. On 17 September 2007, Arthur's pleaded guilty in the Supreme Court to charges of murder and unlawful detention. The two counts of sexual penetration of a child under the age of 10 were withdrawn because forensic analysis could not conclude if Sophia had been sexually assaulted before or after she died.
Oh.
And I'm just going to say, what a load of old shit. Whether it happened before or after, it happened. And she's 8. She couldn't have consented in any way.
Is it better if it happened before or after? What's the relevance of that?
Would he be charged if it was before and then he murdered her and not charged after? What?
It's just,
has that changed? Is that still the way of things?
I believe it. That's one of the things that comes to change.
Before I get really wound up.
No.
Okay.
No, I will. That's the last bit. I will talk about the changes to legislation, but that is something where I did read in the article that I was talking to you about, where they had interviewed the parents a couple of years later, and they're talking about how the father's very calm and they're speaking to him, and Josephine's not saying a great deal, and they start talking about, you know, what rights did she have and what they've done to their daughter, and their biggest concern is always that, you know, that he'll get out. And Joseph, the mother, says he broke her arms and he broke her legs and he raped her, Josephine says. But the government are telling the people that he just killed her and that's all, but it's not true. And it says she had barely spoken throughout the first part of the interview. When she finally does, her voice wavers and her eyes fills with tears. And she was saying basically the most interesting thing for them was, what does it matter? What does it matter whether she was dead or alive?
Yeah. What the chronology of it is.
Yeah. You know, look what you've done to my daughter. You know, the government are arguing about that's their problem. So on November 7th, 2007, Arthurs was sentenced to life in prison with a non-parole period of 13 years.
Oh,
now, I read somewhere that the maximum in WA, the maximum at that time was 14 years, and they gave him 13 years. He was also sentenced to 2 years for depriving Rodriguez Yutea Sheu of her liberty. Describing Arthur's crimes as so evil they shook the public conscience, Justice John McKenney also advised Arthur of the possibility that he may never be released, as the release of offenders sentenced to life imprisonment must be signed off by the Western Australian Attorney General. Where we find ourselves is in a state where all of these questions have been raised about, okay, because, you know, people are not aware of the laws, right, until something like this happens and they're like, what do you mean? Yeah. It makes a difference whether she was dead before or after. She was raped, you know, all this, and all of a sudden everyone's like, hang on. There's that.
Archaic. Yeah.
Yes. There was
and
also this
common sense. Mm-hmm.
This crime upset people to such an extent that they were talking about, you know, bringing the death penalty back. And I think the last person that had been hung, I think, in WA was someone we talked about, was it Edgar Allan Cook, whatever.
It was that bloke the other day.
Yeah, but it was only 1984 that it was the end of, that's not when he was done, but that was when they outlawed
Capital punishment.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But people were really riled. You know, that was this kind of wasn't, they were after blood. That wasn't enough. You know, they was like, this is not going to work. You know, really need, we need to change some things here. After Arthurs pleaded guilty, it was publicly confirmed that he was under investigation by British police for sexually assaulting another girl in 2001.
In England.
Arthurs was never charged with this incident because he'd left Britain for Australia before an identity parade could take place. So, again, no one knows, but I mean, probably a pretty high likelihood. So where does that leave us? Well, there's a couple of nice things and a couple of changes to legislation. One of them, which I think is really beautiful, and I've seen photographs of this online, is something called the Chapel of the Innocents. And Sophia's small school community was so devastated by her murder that they set about raising funds to create a memorial at the school for her. And they raised over $250,000, which I actually think Paul Litherland was probably instrumental in organising. And what they created was a chapel which was constructed in 2008, and it's not only where it's her resting place, it's where her ashes are, and there's a beautiful stone commemorated to her, but it's for all children who, you know, perish in horrendous circumstances. That's why it's called the Chapel of the Innocents. So it's just this tiny little chapel that's at the school, but I think it's really quite beautiful. And I think for the healing of the family and the community, I'm an 8-year-old girl, that in any school community, if something for so brutal to happen, that affects a lot of people's lives. It's obviously her family, of course. I mean, the staff, the teachers, I can't imagine what it'd be like having your kids go to school and having to be exposed to something so horrendous, so close to their own lives when they're so innocent. Stolen everyone's innocence, right? Now, this is quite interesting. This is where we're talking about changes to legislation. So there's a couple of things that came about. So after Sophia was murdered, police were restricted in their ability to charge Arthurs with willful murder because it could not be proved it was his intention
to murder her.
Willful murder, which carried a term of life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 15 years minimum to 19 years maximum at the time, was the highest charge that could be preferred for the taking of a life. Instead, Arthurs had to be charged and convicted with the lesser offence of murder, which excluded the element of intent. This still carried a penalty of life imprisonment. However, The non-parole periods were 7 years minimum to 14 years maximum. For what many considered to be one of the most horrific crimes in Western Australia for decades, Arthurs might have spent only 7 years in jail. This caused a massive public outcry and demand was made to force a change to the laws, rightly so, in WA. It's scary. Like, when all this is the thing, you know, people just, why would you know? You don't know. And even if nothing happens, nothing would change either, really. It's not like you're going to go and say, oh, I think we need to focus on this. There's so much going on at any given time. This poor child is the reason why changes end up being made into laws, because, you know, it's only when you're going through it and everything seems so antiquated or out of date or just wrong that they can then be assessed given the current situation. So where it leads me to sort of talk about is parole. And in WA, you can be up for parole. No.
That's the parole board answer.
No parole.
Oh.
No.
I'm not going to do parole.
Every
excellent presentation. No.
Years.
Every 3 years.
No. Thank you very much. No.
Yeah. So old mate, Paul Lidland, not having it.
No. He's had the same reaction as me. No.
Yeah. It was welcomed by tens of thousands of people across not only Western Australia but Australia, that a petition was started by Paul Lidland, a former WA police officer of 20 years who is now the cybersecurity expert and whose son was in the year below Sophia at Yanchewup's Mata Christi Catholic Primary School. And he said it was sort of creeping up and creeping up. I didn't want the time to go past and suddenly find out he had been released without no one knowing, Mr. Lidland said. To know that his decision has been made, there is a resolution for the next 3 years at least, is good to know. But I certainly think that 13 years was manifestly low for what he did. Paul Lidland organised a petition, and I think it's one of those things where every 3 years he continues to be up for parole. I can tell you that he's currently still in Casuarina prison. He was dismissed for parole in June 2019 and 2022, which means he'll be next considered for parole in 2025. But if I can get sort of a sense of where the Western Australian public is on this and how that would be
he's not coming viewed, out.
I think that, and it comes down to Attorney General, that it's probably better off that he remains where he is.
If there's a suggestion that he attacked and did something to a girl in the UK, there's a previous charge as well, and then this one, he's a danger to the public. He should never be
totally
out.
The stuff that was in the house. Yeah, yeah.
The problem is none of those would be admissible because there's no conviction.
I think from a parole perspective.
Well, there's no conviction though.
Maybe not.
So if you had been convicted, they might include them, but suggestions of or suspected of wouldn't.
You're probably right, but also, as Carla said, on the basis of finding photos of other children with their addresses.
Oh, I mean, that bit that they could possibly include, but the other two I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's right, I just.
So that is the story of the gorgeous little lady who is Sophia Rodriguez Urrutia Shu and her incredible family.
Very sad.
And her incredible community. And sometimes the worst things to happen to the nicest best people, not that I know that they are and they're not, but I've certainly think in the face of utter evil and, you know, devastation, that they have really been the most positive example you could possibly think to be. And in more recent stuff, it's all about trying to have the best life they can for their three other children. They really tried to just pull together and push through. And, you know, and then there's nothing about Dante's family. I can't find anything. It's just like I know where he was born. That's about it. There's just nothing. Yeah. I don't know anything about his parents.
Yeah, you'd be pretty horrified. You know, like you'd be like, I don't want anyone to
know. Yeah. That's probably why there's nothing, because it was just, I mean, and this, could you imagine this guy when he went to prison? I'm surprised he's still alive. I did read somewhere early on that he was protected because I don't think he'd be long, but he has proved me wrong. So he's now 39 years old. So that is a story that I didn't even really know the full details of, but sometimes your imagination, I knew kind of what had happened, I guess. But
was your imagination anywhere near as bad as what the reality was?
No, it wasn't, because I think when I think of things like that happening, I think there's more, you know, having to be tricked and whatever else, the brutality of this happening so fast and all over and done with. The amount of times where I've sent my kids into a bathroom or whatever else and gone, okay, I'll go and check now. Yeah. It would have all been done. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That's what I can't get my head around, the speed. And it's not as if this child was on her own and wandered in, no one was looking out for her or watching after her. Her family was there. They were, you know, they were in the toilet with her, but they were totally within the area where she was. They were watching what's happened. It was just, so unlucky that it was her, or I don't know, that he was able to just take advantage the way he was, you know. And I guess the reality is it wasn't her. It was probably going to be somebody else at some point, right? So he, I think, deserves to be behind bars because I don't think he is fit for public life.
You could say he deserves to be behind bars, and I agree that he should never be allowed out in the real world because he's a danger to society. But this is trial by wine, and so I have been percolating on a sentence. I don't know if you've seen Stranger Things series 3, nope. I think it is.
No.
But in that, I don't want to be a spoiler for listeners, but there's a, I don't know, some kind of weird-ass creature. And if you've seen it, you know it's not a creature, but I don't want to spoil it for people. Anyway, there's a thing that happens where people, suddenly their eyes roll back and they levitate in the air, and then their arms are broken, and then their legs are broken, and then their necks are broken, and it's horrific and terrifying. And if it happens to you, it's really bad. And so, you know, there's lots of, that's why Kate Bush's song became popular again.
Oh, because was that one? Was
it part of that? Oh, yeah.
Her eyes go wide and they put the song on, and that stops it from being able to take her mind into the other world or whatever it is. I think he can have a bit of that, Dante. While he's doing the seven levels of Dante's Inferno, i.e. the seven levels of hell, as part of that he's getting a bit of this Stranger Things Series 3 broken arms, broken legs, broken neck treatment. And then, of course, he has to wake up again and go through it all again. And it's not quick. It's not 3 to 5 minutes. So we'll break a leg first. We'll let him say, as a person who's broken her arm in the last week and a half, I can tell you it fucking hurts. Break a leg, like wait a couple of hours, break another leg, wake up a couple of hours, break an arm, more hours, etc. And then it's on a perpetual torture scale because as much as her family have rallied and done the best they can, he stole their little girl and he did unspeakable things to her. And he deserves, in my mind, a very painful punishment.
Nice. Cop that, mate.
Oh, absolutely. Damn.
Take that, motherfucker. I think maybe two other times we've done an episode like this, I've cried. I cried in that, one. That was so upsetting.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have. You looked at the pictures of her?
No, I can't.
Oh, she's just this sweet little thing.
It's too sad. It's too sad.
It's awful.
Clarky, what do you got for him?
First up, I'm just horrified by that, Swanee, and I know that I've probably said it five times because that's the only thing that I can kind of think of to say. Yeah. But I could only imagine if
it's just shocking. Child
somewhere,
yeah.
And you're. No, you're there.
Livingston Gardens. You don't expect shit like that to happen at Livingston Gardens.
Marketplace.
Oh, sorry, marketplace.
If you're responsible for them and you're doing what is, you know, I just can't get my head around going, oh, it's 3 minutes. I haven't been back yet, and oh, 5 minutes. Yeah, and having the poor boy going in there and discovering that, you just, I don't know how you get over that. You know, so. Yet not only how horrific those 3 to 5 minutes must have been for Sophia, but for the families, you know, that their lives are changed for all eternity. And I've been trying to reconcile going through it, why they wouldn't talk about it more. And I think it's because it's so horrific. It's the stuff that boogeymen are made of, you know, like we spoke about Slender Man a while back, but this is a real.
This is worst case scenario of sending 100%. Your child to a toilet. And that's what you have to do it right. You have to do it. That's when you've got little kids or children of 8 years, it happens all the time, right?
Sorry, if I had kids, I'd be putting them now in nappies.
The even poor when they're uncle.
When we go out and say no. Dante
the poor uncle would have been going, I can't take her into the toilet because people will think that I'm doing something dodgy. Check on,
Don't expect a child molesting murderer.
Of course you don't.
To
of
take
course
a
you
child
don't. But even,
like that. You know, like, that's the
but,
point,
but people
right?
might say, well, yeah, he should have taken her to the toilet or something. But men don't do that because that in itself is weird. They'll get,
yes,
because
the other side of the coin,
and
exactly.
So, I 100% agree, Shmi, you don't expect it. You know, I don't know where you would expect that to happen, but not in.
Honestly, it is totally, like it's this whole concept is, it's a massive issue for me to the point now we still, like Jeremy and I will talk about, and the kids will be in a restaurant where somewhere we don't know, and you know that there's the toilet's out the back or whatever else. My kids are no doubt out there sitting on their phones or whatever else, and we'll be like, go and check on your brother, and everyone looks at us. What do you mean? Go check on your brother. Yeah, we still do it now because I just can't handle the thought of just somebody lurking there, just someone being in a place that once you're closed up in a room, what is it? Well, not that I even knew that it was 3 to 5 minutes. That's what
at
I find
the
most.
At the end of the day, ugh, if it makes you feel any better, you know, when we were talking about the Malta case the other day, young men get attacked. You know, like people get attacked.
It happens to everybody. Absolutely. It's not a child. So you're absolutely right. I'm very aware of it.
Parents have
them.
Every right to be worried about their children to the time you die.
Yep.
People generally do worry about it. So don't feel
it's a
like
lifelong
that's
sentence,
weird.
I think.
Correct. Mm. Penance.
That's all right. I'm scared myself when I go.
My sentence is, I think, a cross between Children of the Corn and Village of the Damned. So
right.
I want him to be absolutely terrorized, possibly even chuck Chucky in there. I want him to be terrorized by children.
Natalia?
Well, I was going to say that and I thought, no, that's probably too much.
She was a child.
I know.
I saw that. They've been able to prove it, haven't they?
Also, she was a victim. Yeah. We could do an episode on wrapping up
that.
Stories like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Chucky or child. Anyway, I said child. Yeah. Let's go for it. Yeah. Yep.
So I think he needs to be completely terrorized. And I don't know, part of me says they should catch him and tear him to bits. Another part of me says he should never get caught, but he should never be able to sleep again because he's just constantly in fear.
Just be driven mad by the terror. Yeah.
Yeah, because that would go for longer and probably impact him. I mean, he obviously thinks he's a big brutish bloke who can overpower little children and do whatever the hell he wants to them.
Mm-hmm.
I would like them to enact revenge because that's disgusting. The whole thing is.
Yeah, I had the idea of just feeding him to rabid dogs. But
I really struggle with this in the way that I normally come to a punishment.
A psychological nut punch.
Yes, I don't know which way to go with this because I find that his
glass rod
lack
for
of
a start.
But you know how he doesn't give anything, right? He can confirm yes or no, but takes no responsibility in that. So I don't truly know what his motivation was. But so if I take that away from it, I'm left with, well, what could he do damage with? So I think that little wiener has probably got a
glass
defunct.
Get Sada Abe onto that.
Yeah. Defunct. It'll I'll say that could. That. Be, I don't need to know the whys and wherefores, but defunct. I think that, and you know,
in that part of Trial by Wine world where all our murderers actually continue to exist,
yeah,
we'll send them down to Sada Abe's plot. You know, like Saki House. And she can have a little visit with him and we'll sort that out, yeah? And then what are you going to take off?
Well, I'd also wanted to sort of somehow bring in sort of Dante's Inferno, but I'm struggling with that. I don't think I understand the concept well enough about the levels of hell. But
7 levels of hell, yes.
Hell. Well, I don't have 7 levels, so I don't quite know. I think I was just trying a little bit too hard to be a bit clever with the Dante's Inferno.
With his name,
name. But, yeah, I really don't know. I just think the things that motivate him, he's an evil pedophile, isn't he? That's what he is at the very core of what he was, an evil pedophile who wanted to attack young girls and get pleasure from that and hurt them, harm them. I don't know. I don't think he cared enough. It was so disposable. And
that's what it feels like. Literally.
I don't know how to punish that. It's just like, you know, I can't do the reverse of that. Do you know what I mean? It's not like little girls are going to take advantage of him. Do you know what I mean? I can't use my usual flip. You know how I try and flip things? I can't. I'm just left with going, okay, we'll make him redundant in able to think those thoughts and want to do that. But that's not really a punishment. That's just solving the problem for him, you know, or everybody else. I don't know. I'm not very good. I think being in prison for the rest of his life is exactly where he needs to be, actually.
I mean, incarceration is pretty effective. Yeah.
Yeah.
So is a bit of chemical castration, a little bit of a lobotomy, and maybe cut his hands off.
Sada Abe.
Anyway.
With a sharp sushi knife.
Yeah.
And wrap it up in a little newspaper and carry it around for
there
days.
You go.
Yes, well, we might wrap this story up in a little newspaper and carry it around with us.
Yeah, I'm sorry. In a way, was it
a while? It was.
Yeah,
it was very
I don't
upsetting.
Know if it was.
It's important though because it's, you know, like it, the salient part of this whole story or the bit that really sticks with you is how quickly that happened.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's not a took like even in the Jamie Bolger story, they took him out and led him out to the. Like there were all these opportunities to try to
no weapon
you know, maybe save
as well.
Yeah,
I just think you know that is also that's not someone having a knife or a gun or anything. It's just someone with that
physical strength,
physical force, or anger, or whatever else. Just go rightio. This is how it's going to go. That is terrifying, right?
All right. Well, on that awful note, let us say, as we say every week, miss you already.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Trial by Wine. You can contact us at trialbywine@gmail.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Trial by Wine on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support us, you can become a patron at www.patreon.com/trialbywine or visit our website www.trialbywine.com to donate to us. Your support will help us cover many more cases and apply wacky sentences. We really appreciate you listening and hope you tell everyone about us. Our cover art is by John Christo and music is by Beauchamp from pixabay.com.